The idea of a Department of Peace comes from the belief that we can work to make nonviolence an organizing principle in our society.
I don't see it as being an invasion of Iraq. We believe it's more of a liberating the people of Iraq.
Those of us who are against this conflict are the ones who are the true realists, actually. I think it's idealistic to say, oh, we're going to go bomb a country into democracy.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, April 8th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Civilian casualties in the context of war. We'll talk to an Iraqi exile for her perspective. One of the three Catholic nuns convicted for spraying their own blood on a nuclear missile says she has no regrets. And anti-war protesters shot yesterday by Oakland police with rubber bullets say they intend to sue. But first, these news headlines.
With headlines for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Daniel Costello.
And I'm Jonaki Lafice. U.S. claims significant enemy fire was coming from both the Palestine Hotel and the Al Jazeera buildings, attacked by U.S. forces, killing three journalists and injuring several more. The U.S. military says its forces were using the inherent right of self-defense and blamed the Iraqi strategy of using civilian buildings for military purposes. A Red Cross spokesman in Baghdad told the BBC the organization had seen no evidence of Iraqi military using the Palestine Hotel as its base and expressed extreme surprise at the attack. The Red Cross is reporting that the fighting in Baghdad is overwhelming Baghdad hospitals. The start of ground operations by U.S. troops in and around the city in recent days have led to a massive increase in doctors' workloads compared to during the aerial bombardment. Drug supplies are running low and several hospitals are without power or water. The UN has described the situation in Baghdad's hospitals as critical.
With the eyes of the world averted to Iraq, the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people has escalated. Six Palestinians were killed today in an Israeli assassination that targeted two members of the Palestinian resistance and killed several pedestrians. Mohammed Galayini reports from Gaza.
The Apache helicopter gunships and F-16 fighter jets fired two missiles at a white Subaru in Gaza. The first missile missed its target and plowed into a group of passers-by on their way to the evening prayer in the Shafi'i Mosque, causing several deaths and injuries amongst them. The second missile hit the car 50 meters away from the mosque and led to the death of Saad al-Arabi, 35, one of the leaders of the Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Hamas, and his companion. According to medical sources at Shifa Hospital in Gaza, six Palestinians were killed as a result of the missile attack. Amongst them were two children, 13-year-old Omar Nassar and 12-year-old Anas al-Kahlout. The number of injured stood at 47, eight of them in critical condition, which could lead to a rise in the death toll. Also amongst the injured were 22 women and children from nearby houses and two men who were at a bakery 100 meters away. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Mohammed Galayini in Gaza.
The United Nations Security Council is scheduled to meet tomorrow to discuss North Korea's decision to pull out of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Heather Risby reports from the United Nations.
Earlier this year, North Korea kicked out the International Atomic Energy Commission and shut down UN surveillance cameras after Washington cut off oil shipment while accusing Pyongyang of trying to develop nuclear weapons. North Korea is the first country to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in protest. It insisted on the weekend that any action taken by the Council would be ignored. Pyongyang seeks to have a direct dialogue with Washington, but the Bush administration, which considers North Korea as part of the axis of evil, has refused to do so. Maurice Strong, special advisor to the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who just returned from North Korea, said today the North Koreans believe they are the next target on the U.S. list of axis of evil. He said the Security Council should avoid becoming a substitute for the negotiations, adding that it should rather help improve the situation. Diplomats and U.N. officials say tomorrow's meeting will have no final word on North Korea. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
150 pro-Bush demonstrators march in India. Binu Alex reports.
This is a demonstration, very exceptional, For the first time in India, some 150 activists gathered today in the western Indian city of Ahmedabad to support George Bush to continue his war against Iraq and finish terrorism. A newly formed outfit, Alliance Against Terrorism, believes that India's long-term interests are best secured by supporting the ongoing American-led war against Iraq. They blame pan-Islamists and leftists for serving selfish and ideological interests by anti-war demonstrations. But it's the presence of a large number of Indians in the US and UK and the proxy war Pakistan is waging in Kashmir that a new law for George Bush has developed. From Ahmedabad in India, Benu Alex, Free Speech Radio News.
From Community Radio KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Janaki Lafis.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. They lay in lines, the car salesman who just lost his eye but whose feet were still dribbling blood, the motorcyclist who was shot by American troops near the Rashid Hotel, the 50-year-old female civil servant, her long dark hair spread over the towel she was lying on, her face, breasts, thighs, arms, and feet pockmarked with shrapnel from an American cluster bomb. For the civilians of Baghdad, this is the real immoral face of war, the direct result of America's clever little probing missions into Baghdad. So writes The Guardian newspaper's independent journalist Robert Fisk from his position in Baghdad. The title of his article, Amidst Allied Jubilation, A Child Lies in Agony, Clothes Soaked in Blood. Fisk goes on to write, it looks very neat on television, the American Marines on the banks of the Tigris, the oh-so-funny visit to the presidential palace, the videotape of Saddam Hussein's golden loo, but the innocent are bleeding and screaming with pain to bring us our exciting television pictures and to provide Messrs. Bush and Blair with their boastful talk of victory. I watched 2.5-year-old Ali Najjar lying in agony on the bed, his clothes soaked with blood, a tube through his nose, until a relative walked up to me. I want to talk to you, he shouted, his voice rising in fury. Why do you British want to kill this little boy? Why do you even want to look at him? You did this. You did it. The young man seized my arm, shaking it violently. Are you going to make his mother and father come back? Can you bring them back to life for him? Get out, get out. In the yard outside where the ambulance drivers deposit the dead, a middle-aged Shia woman in black was thumping her fist against her breast and shrieking at me. Help me, she cried. Help me. My son is a martyr, and all I want is a banner to cover him. I want a flag, an Iraqi flag, to put over his body. Dear God, help me. Ironically, not all Iraqis hold the same view about civilian casualties around this war. Peace Watch spoke with Nadia Mirza of the Foundation for Democracy, an Iraqi woman's group campaigning for a free Iraq. She's an Iraqi living in exile in the U.S., and she fully supports the war.
Well, I don't see it as being an invasion of Iraq. I believe it's more of a liberating the people of Iraq, and we support it because this is the only way possible to get Saddam out of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you say that your position is represents the majority of the Iraqi people?
Yes.
So there were some suggestions that the Iraqi people would actually greet the U.S. soldiers with flowers and come out and just applaud them.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Based on the accounts that we're getting from a lot of the independent journalists there in Baghdad, we have not seen a whole lot of that happening.
Well,
in fact, there's been quite a bit of resistance to the U.S. troops.
Well, that's because they were still afraid. They don't know exactly what's going on, if Saddam's actually, you know, did lose his power, or was he still able to command the Republic Army to do something? I mean, you have to realize that people are very afraid. They can't rise up until they are completely certain that the coalition forces were there to help him.
Mm-hmm. We've also spoken to Iraqis who say that while they do want Saddam Hussein removed from power, they feel as though that is something that they as Iraqis should be able to accomplish, and that they don't really necessarily want to have their grandparents' homes bombed in the process. And I know that there are a number of civilian casualties. For example, the International Committee of the Red Cross said that over 100 civilian casualties were coming into the hospitals every hour. Does the ouster of Saddam Hussein, in your opinion, justify this kind of attack on innocent civilians?
Well, I mean, no, of course I don't want that to happen. But what do you do with somebody who actually sets his army tanks in residential areas?
So the serial number on the bomb that fell in a market was traced to a U.S. company, and many other instances of targeting civilians in a rural area. A family of 14 was sitting and having dinner when a bomb dropped through the roof, killing all but the 4-year-old who was rushed to the hospital. The villagers saw the plane fly overhead in an area that was nothing but farms with cows and camels. Now, I'm wondering, are you concerned about these growing civilian casualties? Of course, there are going to be, you know, accidents in a war, but there seem to be a number of these incidents of civilian casualties to the point where the hospitals are overflowing and the International Red Cross says they aren't able to even keep a credible count or accurate account of the number of civilian casualties. I don't think this is just one stray bomb here and there.
Well, I am concerned, but at the same time, I think the hospitals are, no matter what the number would be, they would not be capable of handling, because they don't, for one, don't have the right equipment, the right medicine that's available to them to deal with the casualties.
That's not what they're saying, though. They're saying the International Red Cross, the International Red Cross, which is a neutral organization, is saying basically that the number of casualties, civilian casualties that are coming in is just so enormous, so immense that they can't even keep an accurate count.
So what's the group? I mean, honestly, I haven't heard of those reports. I know there are casualties, and of course that's going to be, and I am worried about the number of them. However, at the same time, I look at the other picture where we are near getting Saddam out of there, and I would be really not surprised if he's made it even harder for them to reach the hospitals to receive the right aid for the civilians.
Before invading Iraq, the U.S. said that they would govern Iraq by coalition forces led by General Tommy Franks, stating further that there would be no elections for at least 6 months. Yet, the U.S. has said they want to bring democracy to Iraq. Many Iraqis in America were stunned to learn of the U.S. plans to occupy Iraq. This was a unilateral decision by the U.S. and Britain. How much credibility, in your opinion, do they have regarding bringing democracy to Iraq when there was no democracy involved in putting together the coalition that will initially rule Iraq?
Well, that's because you need some kind of a transition, because there's going to be a lot of chaos. In order for those chaos to be dealt with first, you have to put some kind of a team that will take care of everything before any type of elections that can actually take place.
So the team of Americans, you're comfortable with that?
Yes, I'm very comfortable with that, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a number of Iraqis are concerned that that's going to seem and feel more like an occupation force than actually...
No, I don't think so. I think most Iraqis are very capable of knowing that, and the United States made it very clear that the Iraqi people are the right people to rule Iraq. It's just within this six-month period, there will be a lot of chaos.
So if this this transition team of Americans is only in place for 6 months, then you're comfortable with that. What happens, however, if it goes beyond the 6 months?
Well, that's fine also. I don't have a problem with that at all.
A year?
That's fine.
2 years?
I'm fine with it, as long as it takes for it to make sure that democracy will and free society will actually exist in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then having foreigners rule Iraq in a transition period, although it could take several years, is not a problem for you?
No.
How much of your family is still in Iraq?
I have two uncles and who have with my cousins and everybody still living in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And what do they tell you about this
war? Since the war, we have not been able to contact them at all. But I know before the war started, they weren't very happy. They were displeased.
And what does
that mean?
The
country, there is a great deal of poverty going on in the country. People are not getting the right educational skills that they used to. I mean, you have to realize the Iraqis were very educated people.
Could some of that not be as a result of the sanctions, the U.S. imposed sanctions?
No, because if you look at it, how is it possible that Saddam was able to fulfill his empire, build all the palaces and everything? He was still able to sell his oil. The sanctions didn't have anything to do with it. It's mainly Saddam had more to do with it.
Nadia Mirza of the Foundation for Democracy, an Iraqi women's group campaigning for a free Iraq. The International Committee of the Red Cross yesterday reported civilian victims of America's three-day offensive against Baghdad arriving at the hospitals now by the hundreds. Yesterday, the Kendi Hospital alone had taken 50 civilians wounded and three dead in the previous 24 hours. A day after the Turkish parliament rejected selling the country's public forest to satisfy the International Monetary Fund, the ruling AK Party government proposed selling parts of Turkey's beautiful Mediterranean coastline as a means of paying the country's massive $200 billion debt. The IMF has insisted on strict austerity measures for Turkey since the parliament forbid a northern invasion of Iraq March 1st. Under an agreement reached with the IMF over the weekend, 45,000 government workers will lose their jobs and most of the others will have their wages frozen. This after U.S. warplanes accidentally bombed the Turkish city of Urfa three separate times with Tomahawk cruise missiles. And as Aaron Glantz reports from Urfa, the citizens of Urfa are now turning to the United Nations for help in ending the war.
U.S. warplanes have accidentally bombed the villages that surround Urfa three times since the war on Iraq began, with Tomahawk cruise missiles leaving giant holes in the wheat, lentil, and cotton fields that mark Turkey's landscape near the border with Syria. Urfa is more than 200 miles from the Iraqi border and more than 400 miles from Baghdad. But there have been so many bombings that the governor of Urfa has asked the area's citizens to beware of objects falling from the sky. But the general secretary of Urfa's Bar Association, Yaha Demirtal, says the bombing of Urfa is not the reason he's filed a complaint with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
It's important that the bombs fell here. It affected people psychologically, but not materially. We are sorry for the people in Iraq because the bombs are falling on them in Iraq and destroying them more every day.
Urfa may seem like an odd place to make a formal complaint to Kofi Annan, but this city of 500,000 is a special one. Urfa is a deeply religious city. The biblical Abraham was born here, and it was here that he shattered the idols of King Nimrod with his father's hammer, beginning the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. 3,000 years later, the king of Urfa became one of the first in the world to declare his allegiance to Jesus Christ. Jesus couldn't come to Urfa for the ceremony marking the occasion, so he sent a handkerchief that miraculously bore his face. Today, Urfa is a deeply Muslim city, and it's one of the strongholds of political Islam in Turkey. Mustafa Bengemis works in the Urfa office of the Saadet Party, Turkey's main Islamic opposition party.
You know, all Turkey is against the war, but Urfa is against war twice because it is the city of prophets. The prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, the prophet Ayub, peace be upon him, the prophet Shaib, peace be upon him, because their graves are here. This is the land of religions. Many of us have gone to Iraq as human shields, about 500 people total.
But despite the local bombings and widespread opposition to the war in Iraq, few residents of Urfa have come out to protest. The streets here are eerily silent and the atmosphere is depressed, with local people staying inside their homes, saving their money in case the war spins out of control. Almost every type of business has been affected by the war. Mehmet owns a local sandwich shop. Right now, there is no one in his store. Mehmet says that since the war started, the number of customers at his shop has fallen by 80%.
I want to say to the Americans that all the people here are against the war. I want the American people to see the people here and in Iraq, how hard the conditions are here where we live.
Like most people in Urfa, Mehmet feels powerless to stop the war. He holds out little hope for the future. The head of the Urfa Bar Association says she doesn't have much hope either, but she says the war is being carried out without United Nations approval, and she says the United Nations should do something about it. Okat Herden is the president of the Urfa Bar Association.
Maybe our fax is just a small movement of a butterfly, but it has to be done, because if the United Nations comes together, it will mean something.
United Nations officials in New York did not return phone calls seeking comment on this story. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz with Özlem Sürüyıldız in Urfa, southeastern Turkey.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio, reintroduced legislation today to create a Department of Peace, a cabinet-level agency dedicated to peacemaking and the study of conditions that are conducive to peace. Kucinich, also a Democratic candidate for president, first introduced such a measure in July of 2001. He announced the legislation today at the Capitol.
We cannot protect retirement security in America if we're spending money on war and tax cuts. We can't fix our schools if we're spending money on war and tax cuts. The Democratic Party has a responsibility to offer an alternative, and we failed to do that as a party. Nevertheless, two-thirds voted against the Iraq resolution. And once again, I'm proud to join with my colleagues here in leading the way to provide an alternative within the Democratic Party to suggest that war is not inevitable, to suggest there can be a path to peace, to suggest that we can reclaim our domestic agenda, and to suggest that in doing so, we truly offer the possibility of people in this country being able to have decent schools, health care, retirement security, and jobs. Last week on the floor of the House, I called for the war to end now and for the UN to come in. This concept is brought forward at an important moment in our country's history and in the history of the world. There's a type of thinking which today assumes that war is inevitable and that the idea of peace itself is archaic. The Department of Peace seeks to address that directly through creating a structure in government which will make nonviolence an organizing principle in our society.
Democrat Dennis Kucinich announcing his plans for the formation of a cabinet-level Department of Peace. The congressman spoke recently with Suzanne Kreider from Pacifica affiliate KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
The idea of a Department of Peace comes from the belief that we can work to make nonviolence an organizing principle in our society for domestic as well as international policy. At this time when our nation is in conflict with other nations, it's important for us to remember that we have the capacity to make war archaic, but we have to work towards those conditions. And the work can begin within government by creating a structure in the government to facilitate the creation of peace domestically and internationally.
So what would the structure be like? What would a Department of Peace do?
Well, on a domestic level, it would address those issues in our society which we're all familiar with, but which there's seldom an organized approach to dealing with: domestic violence, spousal abuse, violence in the home of any kind, child abuse, abuse of the elderly, problems that occur in our community, such as gang violence, violence in our schools, violence between police and various groups and communities, racial violence, violence against gays, anything that is a symptom of our society's inability to basically tame those impulses that seem to find a way of breaking out. And yet through education, we can create vehicles which can help to teach mediation, to teach children values of peace sharing, peace giving, mutuality. The idea is that through having a coordinated approach where the federal government supports either existing programs or helps to create new programs, we can create an awareness in our country that that we can actually work towards making this a more peaceful country.
But aren't we talking about reorganizing government? Because a lot of these domestic initiatives you've talked about are currently under Health and Human Services, for example.
Well, there is no, you know, there is no overall organized approach within the government. This isn't only about government reorganization. There are programs which do support peaceful initiatives, but they're not really the work of the entire structure of government. But the idea of a Department of Peace is to demonstrate the commitment of the government to a broad-based approach where we would make the work of peace a national calling, and to have it be brought into every area of American life. And the way that you do that is to create a department which shows the significance and the importance of it. I mean, right now the United States spends over $400 billion a year for a department which is involved with armaments, involved with aggression, which is called upon to protect our country, but the meaning of it has been transformed as of late. We can change the awareness of the need for peace, make peace an overarching concern in our society through creating a department which the everyday work of that department is to inform the programs at every level of society.
When you say war can be archaic, we're really talking about social change, changing people's attitudes and beliefs. Can that be done through a government agency?
Well, of course, not alone, but we have to understand the impact of government in our society as a primary generator of those structures which create reality. A $400 billion defense budget says a lot about creating fear as well as the potential for war. The creation of the Department of Peace in and of itself presents the potential for the awareness that there's another path towards maintaining our society. The kind of social change which is needed can be furthered by creating a structure inside the government, just as the awareness of health problems in this country created the Department of Health and Human Services, the awareness of the need for a coordinated approach for education created the Department of Education, the awareness of a need for an approach on the environment created the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, whether or not those agencies function to their fullest is always a matter of debate, but what isn't debated is that the principles which brought about their creation represented the goal setting of a society. And we need to set goals for peace, and that's what a Department of Peace would seek to do.
So how much support was there initially in the House, and how much do you think you can get to further this initiative?
In the 107th Congress, there were 44 members of Congress who co-sponsored the bill. In this Congress, I expect that we'll get even more.
And do you think the war in Iraq has made it less likely or more likely that a Department of Peace has a future?
I think it makes it more likely, because people see that our nation has this capacity through its leadership to unleash aggressive war. And I think it's alarming many people when they find that a nation has a lack of anchor point to ensure that the tendencies towards war are tamed at the bureaucratic and administrative levels of a government. A Department of Peace would give a president options. A Secretary of Peace would be in on a cabinet meetings talking about the urgency of resolving matters in a nonviolent way and coming up with programs that do just that. So war is not inevitable. Peace can be inevitable if we work towards it. It's just that at this moment in American history, we're not working towards peace. Our government's working towards war.
We've heard some peace activists are very disappointed with Democratic lawmakers. Lawmakers who opposed the war and then stopped criticizing it once it began. Is it possible for a politician to stand in opposition to the war without appearing in opposition to the troops?
Well, I support the troops, but I oppose the mission. The troops should never have been sent to Iraq. And if we really support the troops, we want them brought home. The very fact that an administration would try to gain public support for an illegal war by saying that, well, we must support it now because the troops are there. The war against Iraq is illegal. It's immoral. Our troops should never have been sent there. And as a person who led the effort in the House of Representatives to organize members of Congress to vote against the Iraq resolution, I'm once again leading the effort, calling on our troops to be brought home, on the war to be ended immediately. And I think that that's the only way to prevent the kind of carnage which continues to occur.
Congressman Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio, who reintroduced legislation today to create a Department of Peace. He was speaking with Suzanne Kreider from Pacifica affiliate KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.